Welcome back, everybody. Talking with Bob Sagerson. I'm a Central Catholic Thunderbirds all-time winning coach, former teammate of mine in high school. Last session, before we left, I told him we were going to talk about his beloved bride. And I know it's difficult for spouses of coaches in a lot of ways. Physically, it's difficult because a lot of times you need to be there at home and you can't be, and they have to take care of things. I know they hear things and people talk about, you know, your successes and a lot of times they talk about your losses and your wife has to defend that type of thing. But how'd Janie react to your coaching career?
Well, you know, I started dating Janie as a junior in high school. And we dated for almost on and off for like 7 or 8 years before we got, almost 10 years before we got married. And some of that was because she wasn't completely sold on this coaching thing. I think. I mean, she wasn't a big jock. You know, she wasn't attracted to me because I was a jock. Let's put it that way. And once I decided to get into coaching, she was obviously very supportive. And you're right. It's amazing what a coach's wife has to put up with. And I've often said that, you know, coaches got to realize that your family hears all the critics in the stands, but they won't tell you about it. Mm-hmm. You know, they take it and they hold on to it most of the time. And so, you know, that's a burden that they carried. I always felt like every accomplishment that we had as a team or I had as a coach that Janie shared in it. In fact, when I won my state championship in 2010, I had told Janie, if we win this game, because we knew it was our last game. Our players didn't know that. But I said, come down on the court. I want you to be on the court with me. So when the ceremony, when it was over, you know, they give you a trophy and they, you know, they hang a little medals around your neck. Well, Janie was with me. And when the president of the OHSAA put his medal around my neck, I took it off and I put it around my wife, Janie's neck. And I gave her a big kiss right there on the court. And that resonated. You know, I still have a lot of wives come to me and say, oh, that was so cool. But I meant it. I mean, I wanted her to be a part of that. In fact, you can see over my shoulder, there's a picture on the wall. I'm looking at it myself. That's why I see it. And I've got my hands raised. And that's what I did after we won the state championship. And what I did was, it was the first time in my coaching career that I did not go down to the other coach and shake a hand immediately. Mm-hmm. Win or loss, I always did that. Mm-hmm. I was in another place. I turned and I walked with my hands up towards the LCC crowd. It was a huge crowd that day. In fact, it was the biggest crowd to see a state championship game in the last 10 years in Ohio. Wow. And it was against Orville, Bobby Knight's great team. Anyway, when I was walking to her. I found her in the crowd and I had my hands up and I was walking at her because I knew she was just as relieved as I was because she had been through all this. Yeah. And the other thing that kind of happened is over time, I think Janie began to appreciate what coaching was and how much impactful it was in the lives of a lot of young adolescents. Because, you know, as a coach, one of the nicest rewards you get is when an athlete comes to you later on and thanks you for your, you know, for the what you did to help with their character and just discipline and just growing up and, you know, from adolescence to a young man. And a lot of times athletes don't see that, you know, like I was telling you before about my college coach. A lot of times, you know, when you're coaching them, you got to be hard. You know, you got to make them do what they wouldn't do if you weren't standing there. Right. So it's not buddy buddy. And so sometimes you've got to, you know, sometimes you got to be hard on a kid. I not Bobby Knight hard, but you have to be, you know, you have to really get it. And so I used to often say, I really didn't care what those kids thought about me when I was coaching. Sort of did, but really that wasn't important. What was important to me when I was coaching was what those kids would feel about me when I was 30, when they were 30 years old. And they look back and appreciated the role that our coaching staff had in developing them as a person, you know, with their character. And so Janie began seeing that and she began to appreciate what coaching really was. And I think that was a real breakthrough for her. Not that she, you know, was against my coaching at all. She wasn't. But I think she began to see how impactful it was and that kind of thing. So I would never have been able to accomplish what I did without her. I mean, she was just a big part of it. And then when you lose games, you know, and you come home and you're awful, and then there she is and she's cooking you a good meal. Although I have to tell you, one time early in my career, you know, Joe, how it is with coaches. As the season goes on, you get more and more, yeah. It's in your head, man. It's yep. just there. It's every day. And I remember one time after a game, I'd come home after a tough loss, and she had made me a steak and a potato, you know, and that was just great. I was sitting there and I eating that thing, thinking about that game. And she picked up her steak knife and she pointed at me and she said, you know, because she was asking me all kinds of questions and I was not answering, you know, I'm thinking about the game and stuff and I'm not communicating with her. And she took that steak knife and she pointed at me. She said, you know, if I cut the head off, if I took this knife and cut a circle around your head and popped off the top of your head, I'll bet 1,000 little basketballs would come bouncing out on this plate. And I just broke out laughing. Hopefully she didn't have to prove the point, but it's true that, you know, you become so consumed by it after a while that you're waking up at night and you're thinking about it. And you know, so trying to keep that communication alive with your wife, it's sometimes hard to do because you become so preoccupied. So one of the things I've often told coaches, you know, at clinics and stuff is before the season even starts, get out a map, you know, get out a calendar, put your games on there, put your scouting schedule on there, put your practice, get it all out. But then every couple of weeks, save one night that and put, bracket it in yellow. And that's the night you take your wife out. And don't ever change that. You know, don't, you know, because she's going through it more than you are. And we did that over a period of time. You know, Joe, the other thing I advise a lot of young coaches to do, Joe, is I kept a journal. You know, I had a black book, big fat book. It was a nice one. And I would put my practice schedule in there, very detailed practice schedule. But I would also leave room for just daily thoughts, you know, just thoughts of the day. And it's amazing and very blunt thoughts. You know, Joe had a lousy practice tonight. Jim was late. Or, you know, even comments about things that were going outside, you know, our lives, you know. Janie had labor pains tonight, you know, yesterday, everything. And so at the end of the season, I can go back and I can look at it and reactions to games, and it becomes almost like a journal. And I have like 32 of those things. And what I do is I give them after about 5 or 10 years, I'll give them to one of the seniors on the team. And and they love it. Because they go through and they read stuff. They're not just looking at practice stuff. They're looking at my comments. And I'm drilling some of them. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm being very positive too. But, you know, if you're a coach, you get mad at your kids sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, lousy practice. Joe's in love with, you know, this gal and his head's not in the game. You know, that kind of stuff. But so I've got those things and I give them away to the players. They fight for them.
Oh, that's great. That yeah. is a great idea. You're a man of faith. How did that affect your coaching and how did you use that to help develop the whole person?
Well, Joe, I was, you know, Irish Catholic family. You know, we were one of those Irish Catholic families that during Lent, we were saying the rosary, the whole family, 9 kids, 2 parents, a grandfather kneeling in the living room around the couches saying the rosary during Lent. So I was raised Catholic. I went to 8 years at St. Charles and then Lyme Central Catholic for 4 years. I went to St. Joseph's College, a Catholic school and institution. I went to Mass many mornings there, obviously team Masses as well. And then I coached at a Catholic school and Guidance Counselor for over 40 years. And so my life revolved around the Catholic faith and Catholic Church has taken some legitimate hits here in the last, you know, 5-10 years. But my faith has stayed intact. You know, I think one of the greatest things that my mom and dad left for me was my faith and the power of prayer. And, you know, I would talk to kids about that in a very real way. You remember, Joe, the old gym at Lima Central Catholic that we practiced in, and for the first 27 years of my coaching career, we never played a home game. We were always playing somewhere else, but we practiced there. Well, there was a chapel right next to it. In fact, that chapel had doors that could open up into the whole gym.
Yeah.
Well, when I took my kids into chapel, they knew it was serious. And we would go in there and, you know, and I would talk about prayer and I would talk about my faith and I would talk about what it meant to me and how it's carried me through difficult times. And I've told that story before, even a couple times, not many times, but in that last season, that state championship season, we caught up to a horrible start. And when we lost a game after Christmas to go 4-5, I took him into that chapel. And it was in that chapel where we dedicated ourselves to turning this thing around. And we did it with prayer. I never prayed to win. Mm-hmm. You know, I never wanted them to pray to win, although you'd always put your hand in the huddle and say, Our Lady, Queen of Victory, pray for us. And you'd run out and, you know, they were doing that back in the day. I remember back in the day when you used to do the whole side of the cross before a free throw.
Yeah, that's right.
That didn't help me much. But you know, prayer was such an important part of my life, and I wanted my players to understand that. And, you know, we didn't have all Catholic players either, but they understood the message of prayer in many cases better than some of our own kids, you know, the Catholic kids. But, you know, I wanted prayer to be an important part of our message, and it was. And I one of the things I like to see today is guys come back that play for me that, you know, they carry on that message. They got it. They get it. And it's a part of their life.
Well, that has to be rewarding. One of the things that I mentioned a little bit about it in the book, very seldom do we get feedback from the success that we have had in developing people, you know, and when you do get that feedback, that it just makes you feel good. It makes you feel like, yeah, it was worth all those late nights, you know, driving home in bad weather and what have you, makes it worth it. So, and I'm sure that it's the same way in high school as it is in college. I don't know about the professional level, you know, I would think that even there you could touch some lives. I know there was a coach at the Warriors that got there before Kerr. Can't remember his name. He was a guard and now he's a commentator. But they had prayer groups, you know, so even at that level, I think you can affect people's lives. So, we talked earlier about players making plays and you were, in particular, you were talking about down the stretch, you know, when somebody steps up and does something that basically wins the game. It's not always making a shot or blocking a shot or whatever, but one of the frustrations I had, and I talk about this in the book also, is we had so few of those people in my program over 12 years. And it wasn't because they weren't trying. I mean, it's nothing about the players. It's just when it came up to a position of having to make a play, very seldom did we have somebody that stepped up and made the play. My question to you is that something that can be taught?
Well, to a point it can, and we used to do a lot of game time situations, you know, late game scenarios, ball to bounds, side, bottom, 10 seconds, you know, run a play. But isn't it amazing how many times in late game situations out of a timeout, you can draw up a play that you've run before and you show it to them again and they go out, but because of the pressure of the moment, one of them doesn't go where they're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it just all breaks down. It happens all the time. And I you know, you got an 17-year-old kid with a big crowd screaming, you know, because it's a tension, most tense moment of the game. A lot of times it breaks down. So it really does come down to those moments where, and I think people are born with it. I had a great player, Aaron Hutchins, who played at Marquette. Yeah. He was one of those kids that at late game situations, my play was give him the ball and get out of the way. We call it this. And it worked. And you know what? It worked at Marquette too. I mean, he didn't get 10 picks to get open. He just got the ball and got out of his way and he would create something. And so, you know, those kind of scenarios are it's difficult to teach. Although in basketball, you know, one of the rules of basketball, I don't care at what level, every game, every great game comes down to the ability to execute in the half court or the ability to defend in the half court. All great games come down to that very simple scenario. So I used to start, I had a very popular camp that I ran in the summer, and I used to do situational tournaments where I would create last second scenarios, and we'd play about 10 of them in a row all over the place, all these different teams, just to get kids to start thinking about those last second situations. But it's amazing how when it breaks down in the end, somebody just makes a play. And 9 times out of 10, it's just a great player who has got the confidence in the moment to make a play like that, even though you may not have designed it, or even maybe you designed this great play and it just didn't, it broke down. So this kid took it on his own and made the play. I've won games like that and I've lost games like that when I had to say I can make a great play. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it is. But as far as teaching it and getting it into them, boy, I'll tell you what, some kids just rise to that level in the moment. And some kids, the pressure of the moment is just too much. Mm-hmm. And they just can't do it. And you can't blame them for it.
No. And that was my experience. I mean, our kids tried. They did. It had nothing to do with their desire. And it just had everything to do with maybe it was luck. Bad luck in my case. It was luck. Let me ask you about, Do you think there's a difference between coaching at the college level versus coaching at the high school level?
I think it's different because you're dealing with a different age level. Mm-hmm. I really think there is a difference in that. And I think that when you're dealing with adolescents that are 15, 16, 17 year olds, that's a lot different than when you're 19, 20, 20, because you know these are young men then. So I think they take on more responsibility. I do think the game has changed. There's no question in my mind, just since I've been out, since 2010, these athletes are bigger, they're stronger, they're better. Their skill level is becoming higher because they're doing more skill work now than they've ever done. I mean, the skill work that they're doing with kids. Listen, I've got two grandsons that live in Columbus. When they were 3 years old, they were in a basketball league. They played in the basketball in Columbus. No kidding. I'd go down and see them play. They had those little like play baskets almost. They didn't even have to dribble, but they had 5-on-5, 4-on-4. And they'd run up and down the floor and play with parents sitting there. They introduced them in a spotlight. Right now they're in the fourth grade and they're on travel teams and they're being coached by people that were college coaches. And I'm watching some of their practices and they're doing stuff that I used to do in high school. I mean, they're practicing. I mean, they're just, you can say it's overkill and it is, but we used to go out on the court and shoot, you know, in the summers. We used to go out on basketball courts. These guys are getting trained by trainers and coaches and they're going through drills and they're going through, I mean, they're better shooters now. Look at the 3-point line. Yeah. When that thing first got open, people almost ignored it. Now everybody's shooting 3-point shots. I mean, the pros, that's all they do. And they're getting better at it. I mean, they're going to move that line out and make a 4-point line, like right near half court or something. They'll start making those shots. It's just amazing the skill level and the training that has gone into all this. That you can point out the negatives, and there are a lot of negatives to it, especially with the younger kids and how much they're being coached right now. It's just amazing. But it's a better game. They're better athletes right now. I mean, you just cannot argue that there's just a lot of great athletes out there right now, yeah. Just hundreds of them.
Let's explore that a little bit. What's your feeling about all this getting kids to play at just one sport, you know, when they're in second, third, fourth grade or whatever, and they start and they're only playing that one sport and they're always coached. They don't go outside anymore and just have pickup games with their buddies, you know, in the driveway. You drive around Kansas City here. I hardly ever see anybody outside just shooting around with their buddy. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, it my generation, I don't like the single sport idea, especially when they're young. I have too many athletes come back to me who played one sport and say to me, you know, I really wish I had played baseball. I really wish I had played football too. I just way too much of that going. But that's what's happening more and more. They're specializing. One of my grandsons is playing at a school where when he goes to high school, there'll be 600 boys in his class, all right? And that means there's 1,800 boys in the top three classes, and he's gonna have to compete with them for a spot. Now, that's why a lot of them say, well, I'm gonna play only football in junior, and I'm gonna play only big, because you know they have these travel teams now where they're playing all summer, and it's almost like they start training them early to get ready for that sport. And the only ones that are playing more than one sport are the real superstars, you know, the kids that are getting D1 looks at one sport or the other, who are just so athletic that they can do that. But you still have this, you know, as you know, in West Central Ohio, there's a lot of small communities. And like Lima Central Catholic is a smaller school now. You have to have athletes that play more than one sport or you're not gonna be able to field a team. So we're kind of in an area here in West Central Ohio where there's a real passionate following for high school sports where you can still see dual athletes playing more than one sport. But that's not the case in a lot of these bigger cities. I mean, that's just not the case anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing from my perspective. And, you know, anytime I was talking with high school kids, and I talk to a lot of them because it's just part of the recruiting process. And you, as you know, it starts really early. And you aren't just talking to seniors. Right. But I'd encourage them to play more than one sport. I think you can get burned out. And the AAU circuit has just done that. In my opinion, has burned out so many kids. I mean, when I'd come into Kansas City and recruit, and I'd see kids that I knew could play at the college level, and I'd talk to them, and they'd say, no, coach, he said, I'm not interested. I'm just going to go to KU, just be a student. Mm-hmm. And now these are kids that had low Division I talent skills, but they were burned out.
I was
always afraid that was going to happen, you know, so I encouraged my sons way back when to play more than one sport. And, you know, when they get older, you know, when they get to be junior or senior, okay, now you can really start concentrating on one if you're really good at it and have an opportunity for a scholarship. So that was kind of my philosophy.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that happens with the change from, you know, playing on our own, developing our game on our own as our generation did, and the next generation that is trained from the very beginning in gyms with coaches, is that loss of imagination, which I think played a big role in athletes like you and I and athletes from our generation, where you could get a basketball and a ball and you could go out onto a court and just you and, you know, you, the ball and the court, and you could get lost in your dreams. I mean, you could play all night and just figure out your own scenarios and I think that feeds into a love, because I think that players that end up becoming really, really good players have an innate love for basketball. They literally fall in love with the game of basketball. And I think it's a little harder to fall in love in basketball when you're at it from the second and third grade. You know, you're playing all these games in the off season. I mean, you know, you're never on your own. Right. And you, like you said, a lot of them do get burned out. And they lose that imagination, and that love never gets a chance to really build inside of them, because they're doing it because they want to, not because, you know, a parent has got this idea that they're going to get a scholarship somewhere down the road.
Yeah. Bobby, I think we're going to take another quick break and come back. When we do come back, I want you to address just what we're talking about here on kids that are scholarship worthy, and your experience with coaching those types and dealing with the parents, et cetera, when it comes to scholarships. So let's take a short break and be right back.
Okay, Joe.
Thanks.